Section 7. The Problem of Compromised Evidence. Everyone agrees all the Christian documents so far mentioned have been selected, forged, meddled with, or edited. In fact, the New Testament underwent a considerable amount of editing, interpolation, and revising over the course of its first two centuries, and not merely as a result of transcription and scribal error, but often with specific dogmatic intent. Extra-biblical literature often underwent even more of the same, with quite blatant forgery and revision not uncommon, as we'll see in the case of Ignatius in the next chapter. We saw it already in the Christian redacting of the Ascension of Isaiah in chapter 3, and of Christian fabrication generally in element 44. This is not something to sweep under the rug. It makes a real difference in how we estimate probabilities. Unlike most other questions in history, the evidence for Jesus is among the most compromised bodies of evidence in the whole of ancient history. It cannot be said that this has no effect on its reliability. This does not entail or require, however, any particular conspiracy theory. Of course, the fact of it is so firmly in evidence it cannot be disputed, only its degree. So even if a conspiracy theory were required, it would be more than amply established by the evidence we have. But it isn't needed, because all that one does need is a sect of fanatical believers who, A, have a common dogma to promote, for example, that Jesus really lived and really said and did certain things conducive to the doctrines they wanted to promote, as we know the Orthodox sect did, and B, have no qualms against destroying evidence, or just not mentioning or preserving it, or forging evidence and doctoring evidence, as we again know the Orthodox sect did. In other words, these are not mere hypotheses, but established facts in our background knowledge. Any such community will organically produce the same effect as a conspiracy without ever having to conspire to do anything. They do not require any top-down instructions or orders to follow, nor any collusion. If each independently did what made sense to him, each on his own initiative, the effect on the evidence that survives for us now will have been the same. For example, no one colluded to forge an ending to Mark. It was not an order issued from the Pope or some cabal of archbishops. Someone just did it. Quite possibly they appended a paragraph from a commentary, not itself intended as a forgery, but passing it off as being by the hand of Mark, and thus manufacturing a forgery. See my analysis of that in my book, Hitler, Homer, Bible, Christ. It then so agreed with what everyone wanted to be there that they increasingly preserved it at the expense of other versions of Mark. In this case, the evidence of this survived for us to detect it. But this will not have been the case for everything. In actual fact, most corruptions and forgeries occur early in a text's history, when it is far easier to eclipse earlier drafts, there being fewer copies of them, less widely distributed, and easier to avoid detection, as the more time passes, the more suspicious a remarkable new discovery becomes. And yet, that is precisely the period of a text's development that we know the least about, because we have few to no manuscripts or fragments to judge from. From the interpolations we have detected, for example, projecting the same rate of meddling back into the period for which we have no manuscripts with which to detect such things, roughly 50 to 150 AD, I calculate there must be at least 20 significant interpolations in the text of the New Testament that we will have no way of detecting, except when we are lucky enough that internal evidence gives us a clue. And again, the actual rate would not then have been the same as in subsequent centuries, but substantially higher. So 20 is a definite undercount. The same goes for deletions, harmonizations, alterations, and destroyed or suppressed documents. That some text has been forged or interpolated or altered by Christians even outside the canon is a caveat I encounter in scholarly analysis of document after document, to the point that it becomes frustrating, and it would be alarming in any other field. And yet, it's so common to this field that it is now simply taken for granted and thus often shrugged off. Already, the fact that half the letters in the New Testament are recognized forgeries warns us against ever implicitly trusting any of the evidence we have. The fact that we can see the same and worse across the whole early history of Christian literature and textual tradition only reinforces that conclusion. And that must affect our estimates of probability. Nevertheless, throughout this book, I shall assume that any passage in the New Testament is not an interpolation, unless I cite or present a specific argument for it, or there is already unanimous agreement among experts, and thus no argument need be made. For example, there are many arguments for interpolations in Paul's letter to the Romans, including Romans 1 verses 3 to 4, which is often cited in support of historicity, and Romans 16 verses 25 to 27, which is often cited in support of mythicism. I do not find these arguments entirely convincing, but neither do I find them wholly without merit. Yet I shall assume these passages are authentic because no conclusive case can be made otherwise. You can see Robert Jewett's Romans, a Commentary, on all of this. Jewett surveys claims that these two passages are not only interpolations, but have both undergone multiple redactions as well. Jewett himself concludes in favor of Paul editing the first and a later redactor inserting the second. That seems needlessly complicated and overly speculative to me. In each case, concluding an interpolation has occurred depends on several improbable assumptions. For example, A, that Romans is a unified letter, when in fact it is probably a mashup of several. And B, that these two passages are not inherited or stylized creedal statements like the Philippians hymn, when in fact they probably are. And C, that Romans 16 verse 25 to 27 says God has abandoned the Jews and only sent his salvation to the Gentiles, when in fact it says no such thing. That last assumption, Jewett bases on the fact that it says the gospel has been made known, quote-unquote, to all the nations, without mentioning the Jews. But the exact same thing is said in Matthew 24, verse 14, Matthew 25, verse 32, and Matthew 28, verse 19, which by no stretch of the imagination can be saying what Jewett imagines. In Romans 16, verse 26, likewise, the phrase does not imply exclusion of the Jews, but furtherance of such scriptural promises as Psalms 82, verse 8, Genesis 26, verse 4, Isaiah 52, verse 10, and Jeremiah 3, verse 17. It is indeed repeated in Romans 1, verse 5, necessitating an assumption of double interpolation. That it agrees with the overall point of Romans 15 confirms that Paul is saying God meant the gospel to be universal and thus inclusive of the Gentiles, which some Jewish Christians were questioning. But he does not thereby imply the Jews were being excluded. Accordingly, I don't find arguments for interpolation in these passages strong enough to count.